Hey, everyone. Jim Miles with Purdue Party Line, the program that we've been presenting all summer, which brings to this microphone various guests from the university and the environs, from the state, visitors to campus, for 50 minutes of conversation in which you, the listener, have a part. You can have that part by dialing 31027. 31027 if you have any questions to ask of our guest. And our guest today, as we told you yesterday, is Dr. R.B. Stewart, who is the Vice President and Treasurer of Purdue University. He's been on this campus since 1925. I couldn't remember. I want to add 1922 in mind, R.B.
1925.
And has been a keen observer, a maker of policy, a fine administrator, a friend of big and little alike all over the campus, and we're sure that what RB has to say today will be of great interest to all of the people who both are close to the university and who are affected by it, as is everyone, literally everyone living within the state. Well, I suppose, RB, inasmuch as for the last five or so years you have been spending the majority of your time on the development of the university physical plant, that maybe we ought to talk that side of this whole affair first, and I'll give you a sort of a open skies question here and say, what do you believe the Purdue University campus might look like by 1970?
Well, Jim, that's asking me to look into a crystal ball, of course. One has to think of what the university will be faced with in 1970. And according to the population data and the experts in population, if we enroll our share of the students who will then be ready for the university, we'll have between 25,000 and 30,000 students by 1970. And for purposes of our shaping the present expansion program, we've aimed it at an intensive use for 25,000 people. Keep in mind that 25,000 students are roughly twice what they are now.
Mm-hmm.
And if we figure a staff that would be twice the size we have now, we will have, crossing the campus between classes, faculty and students, a population about the size of the city of Lafayette itself. Mm. And they'll be going through here every day. So as I look at the campus and we have plans, we now have a model being made which will depict this. We hope to have the model ready this fall. All of the main campus area will then be covered with buildings. And the buildings will fit in with the architecture of the present buildings being constructed. There will be only one or two of the older buildings remaining. But we may have something new in Purdue and this type of university. We may have two or even three, seven or eight-story buildings.
Mm.
In this connection, for example, on the south side of stadium across from the men's gymnasium,
mm-hmm.
we visualize a seven or eight story building matching in architecture the gymnasium. And then, of course, further south from that building will be the new civil engineering building, and the physics building will be extended along Northwestern Avenue, and that will be a quadrangle.
Mm-hmm.
On the triangle across from that, again, the corner diagonally across from the men's residence halls will be the new student health service, which will have infirmary or beds for 90-odd patients, places for suites for 11 physicians, and a psychiatry division, x-ray division, physiotherapy, for rather complete handling of our student population. Keep in mind it'll then be between 25 and 30,000 people.
Yes, and 100,000 or 100-bed hospital would not be very many for a population of 25. Of course, we would imagine in this age bracket that they would be a little healthier than the
normal city. That's right, and that's why we are not figuring we have to go to a full hospital, we must consider the university and its responsibility rather than the city. The city will need more hospital facilities by that time, but this, of course, should take much of our student load out of the hospitals, leaving the hospitals of the city for the major diseases and problems and the resident population.
True.
We'll have to have a new pharmacy building because all of our graduate work in pharmacy, and by the way, Jim, we're very proud of that because that is commonly recognized as the foremost graduate school of pharmacy in the world today. And all of that work, or the vast majority of it, is in a temporary World War II building, which we moved in thinking we'd use it 10 years. It's already been used that long, and we'll probably use it another 5 to 10 years. There'll be a new pharmacy building, and the present pharmacy building, I believe, will be used for the administration of student affairs, because our present executive building is now overcrowded and we have to move some offices out of it. Obviously, as you increase the operation university, you increase the operating load. Well, when we finish that, we pretty well have the main campus covered. The back end of Haviland Hall, the front end being rebuilt now, the back end will be rebuilt in the next 2 or 3 years probably, to provide for the basic chemistry work, freshman, sophomore chemistry, now housed in temporary buildings, which have to be torn out. And we may put a high-rise structure above. This would be something new and probably our first venture in high-rise work. In that idea, we'd put the laboratories for chemistry at the basement, ground floor, and possibly second floor level. Then we would have 2 floors of classrooms, nothing else but classrooms. Then we'd have 2 floors on that for just staff offices, conference rooms, so that the students could walk up to their classes and the faculty in the floors above could be provided with elevator service without too great expense. So we now go to the complete shift in university setup. The old days were, take when Thomas Jefferson built the University of Virginia. The faculty man lived upstairs, a bachelor, of course, and his classroom was under his bedroom, so to speak. And he alone had control of that area. Then our next step was, of course, where a classroom was available to a department. And with our new concept, a classroom is a university-wide facility, and a professor has to go wherever we can find a classroom. This is not the case with laboratories where the
specialized equipment,
is fixed. So we'll probably move in there. There will be a building between the present civil engineering building and the electrical engineering building, if you can visualize it. That will be the, shall I call it, dog leg after the golf course?
Sure.
Dog leg at the intersection of Grant and Northwestern Avenue. And that will be the engineering sciences building. You remember we built a little one-story unit, which is a back wing of the projected front wing. The front wing will be similar in design and character to our other buildings. Well, if we accomplish this, the entire campus, as I say, will then be developed. We should be able to handle 25 to 30,000 students. It'll be very crowded with 30,000. Just as an old schoolman, I know that you can do many things to crowd people into classrooms and extra classes and run night sessions and things, which we might do, and do very wisely. But certainly we will have just about the requirements for 25,000, which is my present thinking of where we'll go.
Now, this presupposes, of course, the completion of the facilities of the Life Science Building.
This is right. Life Science Building and the present Haviland Hall, the home economics buildings will be all in and revamped.
The veterinary school? The
veterinary school will be built, of course, within the next 4 years, probably. We hope to start that late this fall or the first thing in the spring. And if we need buildings beyond this, and of course this is a way ahead of my time, but we're thinking about it nonetheless. We may buy up properties between University Street and Russell Street and build some classroom buildings in that area. And as those old houses are torn out because they become inadequate for student housing and one thing or another of that sort, the university might very well have that for expansion.
Well, there's been no new building in that area other than fraternity and sorority
houses. That's all. There's no new building going on there and hasn't been for years except the new fraternity and sororities. And at the present time, we're encouraging the sororities especially to stay in that territory. And if houses and lots can be put together to provide adequate land, that will be developed in that fashion.
What about residence units, R.B.? We've got H1, 2, and 3 going
on. That's right. We have adequate facilities for the student enrollment now till 1960 or 61. Next year, we'll have facilities for about 1,200 married students. That's more than any other university in the country has provided. But 22% of our students are married at the present time. And this seems to be shaking down to somewhat normal pattern over the country. So if this is the case, we're not overbuilt. We will add with the new H1, 2, and 3 buildings, which will come into use in 1958, another 2,200 spaces for single students. So we'll have about 7,000 spaces for single students, 1,200 for married students, and around 2,500 to 3,000 in fraternities and sororities and cooperative houses. We feel that we're going to have to continue to expand our residence facilities as the enrollment expands because the rooming facilities in the city are overloaded now, and students are living in quarters that none of us are happy with. And of course, those facilities will get older and less useful, and so we will have to build for most of the new enrollment. Now, our next units for residences, I'm trying to think this far ahead, will probably will come probably in the shape of a high-rise building again, west of the present X building, which in 1958 will be used by women. And then west of H1, on the side of the hill, we may put another high-rise building. So they sort of balance each other. We're thinking of the total development of the campus, its harmony, the relationship of materials and design, because we believe that the general effectiveness of a campus is expressed in its unity, at the same time a lack of monotony. So all of us in schools have hesitated to put students in 7 or 8 multiple-story buildings, and yet the metropolitan institutions like Columbia and Northwestern have years ago in the university, well, the dormitories at Pittsburgh aren't high-rise, but Northwestern's downtown campus, they were one of the first ones. They had Abbott Hall during the war, and we found that 10, 12-story buildings could be managed properly. We've been a little reluctant in, shall I say, the campus-type school as differentiated from the urban school like Chicago. We call it sometimes the subway school where people come from home and then go back. We've been a little reluctant to go to the high-rise because the problem of managing the students and giving them a small enough living group so they have the sense of belonging, the sense of security that comes with a home and knowing who you're living with. Can't do this in a hotel and that type of living. University of Washington, a few years back, because it's an urban institution and land is very scarce, built one such unit. It took them 3 years to get it satisfactorily in operation, but they've found how to do it by designing the structure so that about 150 students fall into a unit. That's a little on the large size, and we consider it the maximum size. But they get three floors related together, one up and one down, and the intermediate floor, they have their lounge and dining room, so mm-hmm. that they break mm-hmm. it up into units. And if this can be done, in due course, you will get the spirit of a unified group, which is important in student life and for the security and the sense of belonging and the mm-hmm. relationships of the student as he matures. This is important because, after all, our students begin, it's the first time away from home. Now, in the 4 years here, they emerge as citizens who are metropolitan, cosmopolitan. And to take them from a home environment and then put them in, it's like moving somebody from one of our small towns out here and putting them in a room downtown in New York. Yeah. There's a period of adjustment.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at that age, this is extremely important. It's one reason why ever since I've been at Purdue, the residence hall system has been my baby. Mm-hmm. I think we've got a good one.
I do, too.
But it does something more than just provide a place to sleep and a place to eat. So we are studying this high-rise business because otherwise, if we stay only three stories as we've been doing, we'll have dormitories spread clear out past my house. And mm-hmm. I moved out in the country 25 years ago, so I'd be far enough away never to be bothered. And now the students play in my front yard.
Yes, they do.
And I have to be awfully careful when I go home and I not to run over somebody. Not only some student, but some student's baby.
RB, all of these residence units are not built with tax dollars, are they?
There are no tax money in the residence hall system. In fact, that's an interesting question, Jim. A lot of people think we're throwing around a lot of money and we have an enormous building program. But over the years, the taxpayers have provided for Purdue University around $20 million to date. Mm-hmm. And we have provided from gifts and other sources, including our borrowed money, which is paid back from the earnings of the students' board and room charges, for example, something like $45 million. In other words, less than a third, about 25% of Purdue University's physical plant has been paid for by the taxpayer. Mm-hmm. And this has been done over a period of 80-odd years. Mm-hmm. Now, this is amazing. People don't realize how much of this plant is provided without recourse to taxation.
Party line. Go ahead, please. Yes, just a moment, please. RB, question.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Just a moment, please.
Hello?
Yes?
Yes, go ahead.
I think if the young lady will turn her radio down, she will be less annoyed. This whole problem is a seven-second delay, and I can hear a radio playing in the background, RB, and I think it's bothering her.
Okay,
go ahead.
I wanted to ask them, why did they take the grass away from the Union Building?
Well, so we could grade the lawn and plant new grass. And rather than just plow it up, we scraped the grass off during this summer because we had some areas on a side hill where it saved us buying new sod from some hayfield in the country, shall I say. We have to regrade the area in front of the Union because it never had been graded down, and in order to get it to drain properly, we have to lower it out at the street and grade it back to the building. Mm-hmm. And so we just saved the sod instead of wasting it. The ground will be graded and seeded during August, and we're hoping that the grass will be sufficiently green when the students come back so they'll find brand new grass but won't walk on it till next year.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, fine.
Bye.
I could pursue that a moment further, RB. Whole area there is to have an underground irrigation system, I understand, so that it will be green the year round, or the summer through at least.
Yes, that whole area is now, the landscaped engineers have finished with their plans, and we're proceeding to bring it all to grade. The new State Street, which is laid out with the approval of both the city and the highway department, We call that the State Street Project, but the State Street Project, a very small part of it. The biggest part is the rebuilding of the campus drives, the new drives required for our buildings, and then the grading and bringing it down, putting new water pipes in. And when we're doing that, we're also putting in sprinkler heads scattered around the place so that we can water the lawn and thus keep the front of our campus a beautiful place with a minimum of expense. Mm-hmm. You remember, Jim, in the old days we used to burn up the grass in the oval and then get the water fire hose out and flood the place. And that was the only way we could keep any of the grass green. It got green in spots. Now we will have all of that area landscaped. Our roads and everything will be cleaned up. And this fall, aside from the fact that it will be new, it will all be with a new design. There will be new shrubs, evergreens, flowering plants. We're even going to have some flowers on the campus now, the main campus. And we're going to have a little lily pool in front of the annex building. It won't be way out in front. It'll be between the sidewalk and the building, a place to sit and visit and be in a nice environment. And we're going to have a new entrance to the front of the union, which we think will be attractive. It's somewhat of an experiment. And if it doesn't work, we'll have flowers there. But if it does work, then we'll have something that, again, that will be a feature. Mm-hmm. There are so many things involved in that. Now, one of the interesting things is that while it seems we're spending quite a little money, what we call State Street, some $300,000, actually only $40,000 going into State Street. The rest of it are campus roads and things that have been going to pieces and need to be rebuilt. And the re-landscaping and the watering system and all that. But these are the grounds around a building, the Union Annex, in which we put no taxpayers' money. There's $8.5 million of money that will be paid back by the students through bond issues and the use of the fees by adults coming in. And we're providing for the university, and without cost to the taxpayer, one of the finest library facilities anywhere in the country. The whole fourth floor of that building will have little study rooms where advanced students and staff can get their materials and go up and study and lock it up and leave it until they're through. They can have a study room for 3 weeks study if they want to.
Purdue Party Line. Hello. Purdue Party Line. You certainly may. May I ask if your radio is turned up, however? Will you turn the radio down, and then you won't be annoyed by the variety here. Can you turn it down? The seven-second delay, RB, really bothers people all the time. But all right, are you ready, lady? Hello? Hello? Now, all set? All right, here's Dr. Stewart.
Hello. Yes.
Well, I'm a new employee.
Yes.
And I'm on the switchboard, and I was wondering if there is a place that I could go and get information that would help me in giving information and sort of give an intelligent answer when people call in there. I'd like to learn about Purdue.
Well, of course, that's a good question, and I'm glad you asked it. We do have a bulletin of information for the staff, new staff people. It's really quite a little booklet. And, of course, we have several booklets describing different things in the university for the benefit of new students. Now, don't you feel badly if you don't know all about Purdue in a month or two, because after 32 years, I'm still learning things.
Important.
Yes, well, I think you're right. I think that what you should do is to drop by the Tom Johnson's office in the executive building and let him give you a number of things which he has for information, which in the course of a week or two you might, I know you'd enjoy looking through it and you'd find out many things about the university that would be helpful.
That and directing people to the various buildings. We have a map, but none of your drives are named, are they?
No, all the drives on the main campus are not named. The drives around the residence area are named.
Oh.
And, of course, those on the campus we generally refer to as the Executive Building Mall in front here, or the Men's Residence Mall that goes out that area, or the main entrance, which people still call the entrance on State Street.
Mm-hmm.
And there really are just those three roads that traverse the campus.
Well, Arby, we've been working.
Mr. Tom Johnston?
What's that?
Mr. Tom Johnston, his office, is that what you said?
Yes. If you go to Mr. Tom Johnston's office on the top floor of the executive building, I'm sure he'd give you much material that you could use to begin to assemble the kind of information you want.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right, and thank you very much.
Fine, thank you.
Bye.
Arby, I started to say that it seems to me we've been working for 15 years to get labels on the buildings around on campus,
that's
and
right.
This is now accomplished.
We started that during the war, and then we couldn't get materials, and then people wanted it in bronze, and then we had to get a design, and finally a material. And now that aluminum is plentiful and the chemical engineers have learned by oxidation to make it the color you want, we really have the buildings named, and isn't it wonderful?
Isn't it wonderful? I agree. Purdue Party Line. You can. Will you turn down your radio first, though, or you'll be thoroughly confused? Now, wait just a minute. I'll give you Dr. Stewart.
Hello.
Hello, Dr. Stewart.
Yeah.
I was wondering if the Purdue had set up any sort of plan for giving land to fraternities in the near future.
No, we don't have any land which as yet fits into our development plan for that, but we are cooperating with a number of the fraternities now in endeavoring to enlarge their land areas so that they can come up with a development program. The fraternity system, I take it you're a fraternity man.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. This is one that I'm very much concerned with, and I'm hoping we'll come up with some kind of an answer. The problem here is whether to put them together in one block, shall I say, or whether to take them where they are and gradually acquire adjacent properties, and then by a process of remodeling and adding to and revamping to come out ultimately with new buildings is the procedure. And of course now with tight money markets and high prices, this is a little difficult to move fast. But we're working on that problem, and I have one fraternity, for example, this summer that we've helped, and they've got going on their project. I've got two others that we're working with and helping them. This is not, however, giving them an area on which to build, but rather helping them to move up from where they are.
Okay, Doctor. Thank you very much.
Okay, fine.
R.B., I think perhaps the question that the boy was inferring here is that certainly with all the development of the student housing owned and operated by the university, there'll be no lessening of the fraternity and sorority places in this whole question of student
housing. Of course,
housing.
I said the residence hall system was my baby, and no less the fraternities. I'm a fraternity man and served two terms as the national president of my own fraternity, which I think has a very excellent chapter on the campus, and which is now enlarging its house and making it completely modern, and making all its rooms uniformly attractive, a la the residence hall idea. They're doing it with their private financing. We helped them to secure the loan, which was secured on pretty decent terms. Mm-hmm. But I have this feeling, for the benefit of our listeners, that it would be unfortunate if we allowed a university which serves the people of the state to so develop that everybody lived in a house belonging to and operated by the university. America is a land of similarity, contrast, opportunity, and I hope it will remain that for at least not a century or two. I'm happy that it has been that way during my career. Now, I'm anxious that we have private groups, and I refer here to cooperative groups and the fraternity system, where they, in turn, having the same general ideals as the university, because ideally we all seek the same basic thing which is expressed in the Christian religion.
Mm-hmm.
and emulating the development of the individual. Now the fraternities, if they really emulate their rituals and their ideals and carry it into life, they're a very important factor in the university. And so I hope we always have 40 or 50 good, strong groups, and some of them independent, willing to stand up and take issue once in a while, in order that our students may have alternatives in the way they want to live and govern their lives. And as long as they do it within the framework of our American society and our Christian principles, there's no reason why we shouldn't continue to have these individual differences. I'd hate to see them stamped out by having everybody live according to some one of us in the university who might be charged with the system. You get my point?
Yes, sir, very much so. I must tell our folks that this is Purdue Party Line from WBAA, the voice of Purdue in West Lafayette, Indiana. Our telephone number is 31027, and our program is tape recorded and delayed. But we welcome your telephone calls to 31027. Well, let's move on to away from the physical plant, if I may, for a moment, Darby, to the functions that the university performs. I know again that you've been an observer on this scene for a number of years. What changed? Well, before I even ask it, let's see what the telephone has to say.
Okay.
Purdue Party Line. All right, just a moment, please.
Hello?
I was wondering why there aren't more sororities here on campus when there's such a need for them.
Well, there is a need and there's not a need. The sororities are still expanding, and when the sororities are... when the number of women are such as to... actually need or take care of more houses, I think there will be more. This is always a matter that is a situation. There's no opposition on the part of the university. I think that the problem at the moment is where would the sorority house itself and how would it get started? As some of the properties shake down and we're able to put areas together where... as I told the young men who ask about fraternities, where there would be room for the houses to be built and adequate accommodations, I think the university would be quite happy to have more of them. The problems that we've had up until the last year or two have been the fact that the sororities have been hard put to get sufficient numbers of pledges and people who really join to carry the terrifically high cost of buildings. And this is a real problem because it costs about $4,500 a girl to provide a sorority house. So that, from that up to $5,500. And the interest on that investment requires quite a high charge. Now, we have been increasing our enrollment of women, and we have a residence hall to take care of 600 more. But we've been more or less choking them until we got some of the other problems of the university, the men's enrollment, the married enrollment, and others taken care of. Now, I have the feeling that probably around 1960, you'll see some expansion in sororities. This is just my guess. Because by that time, the facilities for residences that the university has planned and putting in operation will be fairly well filled, and the next phase of expansion will be ready. And I think the next phase will encompass some more sorority houses. Sororities are the ones you're asking about. I don't know whether that's an answer, but that's my explanation.
Yes, that's very good. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Well, I started to ask RB about functions. The function of the university today certainly is different than it was in 1925.
Yes, I think the university, as distinguished from the college, shall I say, the single curriculum program, has changed, not necessarily in function, but in emphasis, Jim.
Oh, all right.
I was talking today with a mural painter about the possibility of developing a mural depicting the spirit of the land-grant college. I'll finish this after your telephone.
Purdue Party Line. Yes, just a moment, please.
Hello.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
The students who live in the Ross 8 brick apartments are charged a school tuition surcharge.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could explain that for us.
Yes. The married students do have children who have to go to school. And the corporate city limits do not encompass the land owned by the university, and therefore these people live outside the school city. And in order to provide facilities for their children to go to school, somebody, of course, has to pay the equivalent of taxes. So a few years ago, we developed the scheme of having this surcharge whereby all of the married students in our family houses paid a monthly surcharge, which we then use to pay the transfer tuition. That's the tuition charge by the school for students who live outside the school district and come into another school district. Mm-hmm. And this is the equivalent of taxes for school purposes. Now, you will raise the question, well, why do you tax everybody?
Yes.
Well, that's a good question. I'm a citizen of Wabash Township. I pay taxes to maintain the school. I'm not fortunate enough to have children, and therefore have never had anybody attend a public school. But I have to pay my share of educating the children of the parents who do have. And the best tax I pay is the one that educates my neighbor's children, because by that process I get future neighbors who are safe to live with. And this is one of the lessons that I think our students and married students, when you take on responsibility for a family, you have to learn. And this is the only way in which we relate any of our charges to the problem of taxes, and it does relate to family responsibility. And we adjust that charge from time to time to approximate the amount of the total school charge. That is, if our enrollment drops off and our married students, for example, didn't have any children of school age, if they were all infants, then we, of course, would abandon the surcharge.
Well, that's what I was thinking about, because yeah, there are so few children up in the area now that...
Well, that's right. But you see, we take all the area, and we have 1,200 families. Not just the Ross Aid departments.
I see.
You see?
Well, thank you very much.
Your graduate students, you're all hard at work up there, and there aren't too many of you with families at school. But it's a family responsibility, and we feel that all of the married students for whom we furnish houses should take care of the problem of public schooling for the children in the area. That's basically what we're doing.
I see. Thank you very much,
okay,
Dr. Stewart.
Now, Jim, as I was starting to say, the function of the university. The old classical university was strictly pursuing studies for truth, and the application of truth was another issue. Well, we'll answer the telephone.
All right. Purdue Party Line. All right, just a moment.
I didn't know so many people listened to you.
I'm glad they were calling.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
Listen, do you think that with an increase in enrollment, it's going to be more difficult to produce high-caliber students and also maintain a high national rating?
Oh, this, of course, is anybody's objective or answer and judgment. The evidence so far would not indicate that the quality of the output is a function necessarily of size. This is going to depend on our ability to get staff. And, of course, this is worrying us no end. Can we double our staff? Well, we can't double our staff unless we increase our graduate school. And the question I'm discussing with Jim Miles now on is there a change of functions will bring this out. Our graduate school is increasing to produce the staff. But a large university doesn't necessarily mean a low grade of student output. In fact, that can be just the opposite.
Well, it depends, of course, on a big extent on the amount of time the instructors can spend with individual students, don't you
think?
Well,
not necessarily. You know, in schools like Oxford, for example, I think President Hovde told me that he spent 2 hours in one of his courses under a professor over there. they consider that Oxford turns out very good students.
Oh, yes.
Now, it isn't always a function of the number of hours the student has in class under a professor. A lot of this work, you know, depends on how much we get the student to do when the professor isn't there.
Well, that's right, too.
And I personally don't look for any diminution. In fact, I think the quality of our student output, as numbers increase, will probably improve also.
I see.
Because I think the urge to get into school is going, and the shortage of school facilities is going to make it possible for us to insist that if people want to come and use the facilities in space, they're really going to have to do more on their own. And if that's the case, they ought to do better work. That'll eliminate the fellow, you see, who comes just for a good time or because he thinks if he has a degree, he has a social passport to American society.
Yeah, I understand that. But it seems to me that if they were to work some way through legislature to limit the number of, some way through tests, possibly the number of students that came here, they could get a higher caliber of students to begin with.
Well, I think we're getting a pretty high quality of students. I'm not one of these that thinks that we're getting second-rate students, because all you have to do is to look at the ultimate output of these people. Now, this is the principle of America, that every person has the opportunity to develop to the full extent of his ability, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Now, then somebody comes along and says, "Whoa, you're not quite good enough to develop to be a PhD, therefore you can't be a freshman." Now, I personally, as an educator, resist that point of view.
I see.
There may be some waste in this, but even a freshman who comes 1 year and then flunks has learned a very valuable lesson, and that is that he can't get by life without working at it.
He may have a harder time getting in somewhere else.
Well, that's right. But you see, it's not waste effort in the development of a human being. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is important for us as Americans to cherish and not buy the test too fast.
I see. Well,
I think the test has something. We go by the high school records and what the student has accomplished and the obvious misfit. We do a lot of screening. You've got to have certain types of capacity proved by your high school and other records before you can take some of our professional work. But I myself, for example, could no more be an engineer than I could fly without wings. But I can do some other things.
Yeah, I understand.
And some of the engineers, vice versa.
All right.
You get it?
Yes, I do, sir.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stewart.
Well, now, Jim, maybe we'll finish this function. We have come along now where just the pursuit of knowledge is still a function. But we also are relating the knowledge to serving mankind in one way or another. And this is what we mean by improving our standards of living. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing that's happening, the university is the one area where we are training the people in the advanced areas of learning and science. And we are the source. If we don't develop these people, the laboratories for industry cannot be manned, because right. No laboratory in an industry is teaching anybody. They're doing. They're applying the knowledge that they have gotten. Now, since the war, since 1940, we have greatly increased our function of research and advanced study. And while we are doing this basic study and we're teaching, and while we're carrying the word out to the people through our extension, we're doing a great deal more in the graduate level and in the frontiers of knowledge, research work, than we did before. And this is expensive, but it's the critical thing that the universities must perform. And if universities don't perform it, we certainly are going to sell America short. This is the area that should never be restricted in our universities.
This is the basic research?
Basic research, as this must be carried on. Now, you mentioned basic research. This, of course, is just the pursuit of abstract scientific phenomena, our understanding of the world. Mm-hmm. Now, with this, obviously, our American economy and the world today is looking to it, is to take that basic result and apply it. Mm-hmm. And so basic research and applied research overlap. And you seldom get something that is pure basic research or pure applied research. You get a combination in the university. And you get teams of scientists, therefore, some who are just theorists and some who are something else, and the sum total go into the PhD and the graduate that really carry on the great advances in American industry.
Well, then we've changed our pattern of research. Seems to me I've heard some complaints that we were literally running away from the basic research that we had and that we were living in the past and not replenishing this basic research knowledge.
I disagree with this wholeheartedly. There perhaps is, I don't think there's any diminution of basic research, but the other has been added and the whole has been expanded. And so they're more conscious of the applied than they are the basic. But we have a whole section in our physics department we call theoretical physics. They're not concerned with what happens to it. I'm a director of a university research organization that we've put 15 universities together, physicists in the Middle West, and we're developing a new atom smasher that will use 100 billion electron volts. This is going to smash the atom so fine that nobody now knows what we think is a small particle may look like a mountain compared to what we'll ultimately find. Now, these people, we talk about this as atomic energy and so forth, and we have to get money from the federal government, the Atomic Energy Commission, to develop this stuff. This is a $100 million research program, but it's basic research.
Sure is.
And it is what will explain the universe to us. And all these physicists are interested in is what is the nature of the universe, not how to make it serve Jim Miles and R.B. Stewart better. Now, after these fellows do the basic work, there will be hundreds of scientists who will pick up the one bit of information that's produced and apply it somewhere. And these thousands of people who pick up this one bit of basic information and apply it, they will benefit Jim Miles and R.B. Stewart.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You see, no knowledge is ever lost. And nobody knows just how much knowledge is terrifically valuable. The formula, for example, the chemical or physical formula that was the basis of the atom bomb, rested for 50 years before somebody conceived the ultimate result of this, and then they tested it. The applied research then went ahead, which made it possible.
True.
And all of our so-called reactor research to develop power plants with atomic energy, this is applied research, but it's also using basic research to find out what happens to the atom and how to do this and the other thing. You've got to go back to the basic stuff, and then you work with the other. Now, these teams now work together, and so you have both sides working in the university laboratory.
Purdue Party Line. All right, just a moment, please. This will be the last, I expect, Irby.
Hello.
Can you tell me when the new outdoor pool will be ready for use?
When the new one?
Outdoor pool will be ready.
Ha ha! That's 15 months late. Yes, we've told the contractor we're going to take it over August 25th and start to use it this fall. He better get out of the way. That's a specific answer.
Okay, thank you.
I hope Mr. Kettlehot hears it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's a good one. I'll end up on it after all of this sort of fancy stuff. I hear something specific.
Getting something of philosophy of education and what's going to happen for the opportunities of American youth if we wind up and go swimming.
That's a good idea. A real good idea today. Thanks very much for being with us, R.B. I should tell our listeners that when R.B. came into the office about 10 minutes to 3, he says, "What in the world are we going to talk about for 50 minutes? And I'd already given him a list of 6 questions that I thought we might touch. I think we may have hit 2 of them, didn't we?
That's right.
Well, we'll try again one of these days then before long if I can pry another hour out of your busy schedule.
Let's start on a different question.
All right, fair enough. That will do. Our guest today, Dr. R.B. Stewart, the Vice President Treasurer of Purdue University. Tomorrow on Party Line, Johnny DeCamp will have Dr. William Ferguson, orthopedic surgeon here in Lafayette, and they'll be talking about highway accident injuries. We think that you'll find that program most interesting, too. Our program today, tape recorded, and we hope you'll join Party Line tomorrow at 3:05. Until then, Jim Miles says a pleasant good afternoon, everyone.